The circuit route through the small towns, the short stay of each girl, the discipline, the percentages. He felt his way along and made few mistakes. He never sent his girls into the cities. He could handle the hungry constables of the villages, but he had respect for the experienced and voracious big city police. His ideal stand was a small town with a mortgaged hotel and no amusements, one where his only competition came from wives and an occasional wayward girl. At this time, he had 10 units. Before he died at 67 of strangulation on a chicken bone, he had groups of 4 girls in each of 33 small towns in New England. He was better than well-fixed. He was rich. And the manner of his death was in itself symbolic of success and well-being. At the present time, the institution of the whorehouse seems to a certain extent to be dying out. Scholars have various reasons to give. Some say that the decay of morality among girls has dealt the whorehouse its death blow. Others, perhaps more idealistic, maintain that police supervision on an increased scale is driving the houses out of existence. In the late days of the last century and the early part of this one, the whorehouse was an accepted, if not openly discussed, institution. It was said that its existence protected decent women. An unmarried man could go to one of these houses and evacuate the sexual energy which was making him uneasy, and at the same time maintain the popular attitudes about the purity and loveliness of women. It was a mystery. But then there are many mysterious things in our social thinking. These houses ranged from palaces filled with gold and velvet to the crummiest cribs where the stench would drive a pig away. Every once in a while a story would start about how young girls were stolen and enslaved by the controllers of the industry, and perhaps many of the stories were true. But the great majority of whores drifted into their profession through laziness and stupidity. In the houses, they had no responsibility. They were fed and clothed and taken care of until they were too old, and then they were kicked out. This ending was no deterrent. No one who is young is ever going to be old. Now and then, a smart girl came into the profession, but she usually moved up to better things. She got a house of her own, or worked successfully at blackmail, or married a rich man. There was even a special name for the smart ones. They were grandly called courtesans. Mr. Edwards had no trouble either in recruiting or in controlling his girls. If a girl was not properly stupid, he threw her out. He didn't want very pretty girls either. Some local young man might fall in love with a pretty whore, and there would be hell to pay. When any of his girls became pregnant, they had the choice of leaving or of being aborted so brutally that a fair proportion died. In spite of this, the girls usually chose abortion. It was not always smooth sailing for Mr. Edwards. He did have his problems. At the time of which I'm telling you, he had been subjected to a series of misfortunes. A train wreck had killed off 2 units of 4 girls each. Another of his units he lost to conversion, when a small-town preacher suddenly caught fire and began igniting the townsfolk with his sermons. The swelling congregation had to move out of the church and into the fields. Then, as happens so often, the preacher turned over his hole card, the surefire card. He predicted the date of the end of the world, and the whole county moved bleating in on him. Mr. Edwards went to the town, took the heavy quirt from his suitcase, and whipped the girls unmercifully. Instead of seeing the thing his way, the girls begged for more whipping, to wipe out their fancied sins. He gave up in disgust, took their clothes, and went back to Boston. The girls achieved a certain prominence when they went naked to the camp meeting to confess and testify. That's how Mr. Edwards happened to be interviewing and recruiting numbers of girls instead of picking one up here and there. He had 3 units to rebuild from the ground. I don't know how Kathy Ames heard about Mr. Edwards. Perhaps a hack driver told her. The word got around when a girl really wanted to know. Mr. Edwards hadn't had a good morning when she came into his office. The pain in his stomach he ascribed to a halibut chowder his wife had given him for supper the night before. He had been up all night. The chowder had blown both ways, and he still felt weak and crampy. For this reason, he didn't take in all at once the girl who called herself Catherine Amesbury. She was far too pretty for his business. Her voice was low and throaty. She was slight, almost delicate, and her skin was lovely. In a word, she was not Mr. Edwards' kind of girl at all. If he hadn't been weak, he would have rejected her instantly. But while he didn't look at her very closely during the routine questioning, mostly about relatives who might cause trouble, something in Mr. Edwards' body began to feel her. Mr. Edwards was not a concupiscent man, and besides, he never mixed his professional life with his private pleasures. His reaction startled him. He looked up, puzzled, at the girl, and her eyelids dipped sweetly and mysteriously, and there was just a suggestion of a sway on her lightly padded hips. Her little mouth wore a cat smile. Mr. Edwards leaned forward at his desk, breathing heavily. He realized that he wanted this one for his own. "I can't understand why a girl like you," he began, and fell right into the oldest conviction in the world, that the girl you are in love with can't possibly be anything but true and honest.
"My father is dead," Catherine said modestly. "Before he died, he had let things go to pieces. We didn't know he had borrowed money on the farm, and I can't let the bank take it away from my mother. The shock would kill her."
Catherine's eyes dimmed with tears.
"I thought maybe I could make enough to keep up the interest."
If ever Mr. Edwards had a chance, it was now. And indeed, a little warning buzz did sound in his brain, but it wasn't loud enough. About 80% of the girls who came into him needed money to pay off a mortgage, and Mr. Edwards made it an unvarying rule not to believe anything his girls said at any time beyond what they had for breakfast, and they sometimes lied about that. And here he was, a big, fat, grown-up whoremaster, leaning his stomach against his desk while his cheeks darkened with blood and excited chills ran up his legs and thighs. Mr. Edwards heard himself saying,
"Well now, my dear, let's talk this over. Maybe we can figure some way for you to get the interest money."
And this to a girl who had simply asked for a job as a whore. Or had she? Mrs. Edwards was persistently, if not profoundly, religious. She spent a great part of her time with the mechanics of her church, which did not leave her time for either its background or its effects. To her, Mr. Edwards was in the importing business, and even if she had known, which she probably did, what business he was really in, she wouldn't have believed it. And this was another mystery. Her husband had always been to her a coldly thoughtful man who made few and dutiful physical demands on her. If he had never been warm, he had never been cruel, either. Her dramas and her emotions had to do with the boys, with the vestry, and with food. She was content with her life and thankful. When her husband's disposition began to disintegrate, causing him to be restless and snappish, to sit staring and then to rush out of the house in a nervous rage, she ascribed it first to his stomach and then to business reverses. When, by accident, she came upon him in the bathroom, sitting on the toilet and crying softly to himself, she knew he was a sick man. He tried quickly to cover his red, brimming eyes from her scrutiny. When neither herb teas nor physics cured him, she was helpless. If, in all the years, Mr. Edwards had heard about anyone like himself, he would have laughed. For Mr. Edwards, as cold-blooded a whoremaster as ever lived, had fallen hopelessly, miserably in love with Catherine Amesbury. He rented a sweet little brick house for her,
and then gave it to her. He bought her every imaginable luxury, overdecorated the house, kept it overwarm. The carpeting was too deep, and the walls were crowded with heavy framed pictures. Mr. Edwards had never experienced such misery. As a matter of business, he had learned so much about women that he didn't trust one for a second. And since he deeply loved Catherine, and love requires trust, he was torn to quivering fragments by his emotion. He had to trust her, and at the same time he didn't trust her. He tried to buy her loyalty with presents and with money. When he was away from her, he tortured himself with the thought of other men slipping into her house. He hated to leave Boston to check up on his units because this would leave Catherine alone. To a certain extent, he began to neglect his business. It was his first experience with this kind of love, and it nearly killed him. One thing Mr. Edwards didn't know, and couldn't know, because Catherine would not permit it, was that she was faithful to him, in the sense that she did not receive or visit other men. To Catherine, Mr. Edwards was as cold a business proposition as his units were to him. And as he had his techniques, so had she hers. Once she had him, which was very soon, she managed always to seem slightly dissatisfied. She gave him an impression of restlessness, as though she might take flight at any moment. When she knew he was going to visit her, she made it a point to be out, and to come in glowing, as from some incredible experience. She complained a good deal about the difficulties of avoiding the lecherous looks and touches of men in the street who could not keep away from her. Several times she ran frightened into the house, having barely escaped a man who had followed her. When she would return in the late afternoon and find him waiting for her, she would explain, "Why, I was shopping. I have to go shopping, you know." And she made it sound like a lie. In their sexual relations, she convinced him that the result was not quite satisfactory to her, that if he were a better man, he could release a flood of unbelievable reaction in her. Her method was to keep him continually off balance. She saw, with satisfaction, his nerves begin to go, his hands take to quivering, his loss of weight, and the wild, glazed look in his eyes. And when she delicately sensed the near approach of insane, punishing rage, she sat in his lap and soothed him and made him believe for a moment in her innocence. She could convince him. Catherine wanted money, and she set about getting it as quickly and as easily as she could. When she had successfully reduced him to a pulp, and Catherine knew exactly when the time had come, she began to steal from him. She went through his pockets and took any large bill she found. He didn't dare accuse her for fear she would go away. The presents of jewelry he gave her disappeared, and although she said she had lost them, he knew they had been sold. She padded the grocery bills, added to the price of clothes. He couldn't bring himself to stop it. She didn't sell the house, but she mortgaged it for every penny she could get. One evening his key did not fit the lock of the front door. She answered his pounding after a long time. Yes, she had changed the locks because she had lost her key. She was afraid living alone. Anyone could get in. She would get him another key. But she never did. He always had to ring the bell after that. And sometimes it took a long time for her to answer. And at other times, his ring wasn't answered at all. There was no way for him to know whether she was at home or not. Mr. Edwards had her followed, and she didn't know how often. Mr. Edwards was essentially a simple man, but even a simple man has complexities which are dark and twisted. Catherine was clever, but even a clever woman misses some of the strange corridors in a man. She made only one bad slip, and she had tried to avoid that one. As was proper, Mr. Edwards had stocked the pretty little nest with champagne. Catherine had from the first refused to touch it. "It makes me sick," she explained. I've tried it, and I can't drink it.
Nonsense, he said. Just have one glass. It can't hurt you.
No, thank you. No, I can't drink it.
Mr. Edwards thought of her reluctance as a delicate, a ladylike quality. He had never insisted, until one evening when it occurred to him that he knew nothing about her. Wine might loosen her tongue. The more he thought of it, the better the idea seemed to him.
It's not friendly of you not to have a glass with me.
I tell you, it doesn't agree with me.
Nonsense.
I tell you, I don't want it.
This is silly, he said. Do you want me to be angry with you?
No.
Then drink a glass.
I don't want it.
Drink it.
He held a glass for her, and she retreated from it.
You don't know. It's not good for me.
Drink it.
She took the glass and poured it down, and stood still, quivering, seeming to listen. The blood flowed to her cheeks. She poured another glass for herself, and another. Her eyes became set and cold. Mr. Edwards felt a fear of her. Something was happening to her which neither she nor he could control.
I didn't want to do it. Remember that, she said calmly.
Maybe you better not have any more.
She laughed and poured herself another glass.
It doesn't matter now, she said. More won't make much difference.
It's nice to have a glass or so, he said uneasily.
She spoke to him softly. You fat slug, she said. What do you know about me? Do you think I can't read every rotten thought you ever had? Want me to tell you? You wonder where a nice girl like me learned tricks. I'll tell you. I learned them in cribs. You hear? Cribs. I've worked in places you never even heard of. 4 years. Sailors brought me little tricks from Port Said. I know every nerve in your lousy body, and I can use them.
Catherine, he protested, you don't know what you're saying.
I could see it. You thought I would talk. Well, I'm talking.
She advanced slowly toward him, and Mr. Edwards overcame his impulse to edge away. He was afraid of her, but he sat still. Directly in front of him, she drank the last champagne in her glass, delicately struck the rim on the table, and jammed the ragged edge against his cheek. And then he did run from the house, and he could hear her laughing as he went. Love, to a man like Mr. Edwards, is a crippling emotion. It ruined his judgment, canceled his knowledge, weakened him. He told himself that she was hysterical and tried to believe it. And it was made easier for him by Catherine. Her outbreak had terrified her, and for a time she made every effort to restore his sweet picture of her. A man so painfully in love is capable of self-torture beyond belief. Mr. Edwards wanted with all his heart to believe in her goodness, but he was forced not to, as much by his own particular devil as by her outbreak. Almost instinctively, he went about learning the truth, and at the same time disbelieved it. He knew, for instance, that she would not put her money in a bank. One of his employees, using a complicated set of mirrors, found out the place in the cellar of the little brick house where she did keep it. One day, a clipping came from the agency he employed. It was an old newspaper account of a fire from a small town weekly. Mr. Edwards studied it. His chest and stomach turned to molten metal, and a redness glowed in his head behind his eyes. There was real fear mixed up in his love, and the precipitate from the mixing of these two is cruelty. He staggered dizzily to his office couch and lay face down, his forehead against the cool black leather. For a time, he hung suspended, hardly breathing. Gradually, his brain cleared.
His mouth tasted salty, and there was a great ache of anger in his shoulders. But he was calm, and his mind cut its intention through time like the sharp beam of a searchlight through a dark room. He moved slowly, checking his suitcase just as he always did when he started out to inspect his units. Clean shirts and underwear, a nightgown and slippers, and the heavy quirt with the lash curving around the end of the suitcase. He moved heavily up the little garden in front of the brick house and rang the bell. Catherine answered it immediately. She had on her coat and hat.
"Oh," she said, "what a shame. I must go out for a while."
Mr. Edwards put down his suitcase.
"No," he said.
She studied him. Something was changed. He lumbered past her and went down into the cellar.
"Where are you going?"
Her voice was shrill. He didn't reply. In a moment he came up again, carrying a small oak box. He opened his suitcase and put the box inside.
"That's mine," she said softly.
"I know."
"What are you up to?"
"I thought we'd go for a little trip."
"Where? I can't go."
"Little town in Connecticut. I have some business there. You told me once you wanted to work. You're going to work."
"I don't want to now. You can't make me. I'll call the police."
He smiled so horribly that she stepped back from him. His temples were thudding with blood.
"Maybe you'd rather go to your hometown," he said. "They had a big fire there several years ago. Do you remember that fire?"
Her eyes probed and searched him, seeking a soft place, but his eyes were flat and hard.
"What do you want me to do?"
she asked quietly.
"Just come for a little trip with me. You said you wanted to work."
She could think of only one plan. She must go along with him and wait for a chance. A man couldn't always watch. It would be dangerous to thwart him now. Best go along with it and wait. That always worked. It always had. But his words had given Catherine real fear. In the small town, they got off the train at dusk, walked down its one dark street, and on out into the country. Catherine was wary and watchful. She had no access to his plan. In her purse, she had a thin-bladed knife. Mr. Edwards thought he knew what he intended to do. He meant to whip her and put her in one of the rooms at the inn. Whip her and move her to another town, and so on until she was of no use anymore. Then he would throw her out. The local constable would see to it that she did not run away. The knife didn't bother him. He knew about that. The first thing he did when they stopped in a private place between a stone wall and a fringe of cedars was to jerk the purse from her hand and throw it over the wall. That took care of the knife. But he didn't know about himself, because in all his life he had never been in love with a woman. He thought he only meant to punish her. After two slashes, the quirt wasn't enough. He dropped it on the ground and used his fists. His breathing came out in squealing whines. Catherine did her best not to fall into panic. She tried to duck his threshing fists and at least make them ineffective. But at last fear overcame her, and she tried to run. He leaped at her and brought her down, and by then his fists were not enough. His frantic hand found a stone on the ground, and his cold control was burst through with a red, roaring wave. Later, he looked down on her beaten face. He listened for her heartbeat and could hear nothing over the thumping of his own. Two complete and separate thoughts ran in his mind. One said, "Have to bury her, have to dig a hole and put her in it." And the other cried like a child, "I can't stand it. I couldn't bear to touch her." Then the sickness that follows rage overwhelmed him. He ran from the place, leaving his suitcase, leaving the quirt, leaving the oak box of money.
He blundered away in the dusk,
wondering only where he could hide his sickness for a while. No question was ever asked of him. After a time of sickness, to which his wife ministered tenderly, he went back to his business and never again let the insanity of love come near him. A man who can't learn from experience is a fool, he said. Always afterward, he had a kind of fearful respect for himself. He had never known that the impulse to kill was in him. That he hadn't killed Catherine was an accident. Every blow had been intended to crush her. She was a long time unconscious, and a long time half-conscious. She realized her arm was broken and that she must find help if she wanted to live. Wanting to live forced her to drag herself along the dark road, looking for help. She turned in at a gate and almost made the steps of the house before she fainted. The roosters were crowing in the chicken house, and a gray rim of dawn lay on the east. Chapter 10. When two men live together, they usually maintain a kind of shabby neatness out of incipient rage at each other. Two men alone are constantly on the verge of fighting, and they know it. Adam Trask hadn't been home long before the tensions began to build up. The brothers saw too much of each other and not enough of anyone else. For a few months, they were busy getting Cyrus's money in order and out at interest. They traveled together to Washington to look at the grave, good stone, and on top an iron star with seal and a hole on the top in which to insert the stick for a little flag on Decoration Day. The brothers stood by the grave a long time. Then they went away, and they didn't mention Cyrus. If Cyrus had been dishonest, he had done it well. No one asked questions about the money. But the subject was on Charles' mind. Back on the farm, Adam asked him, "Why don't you buy some new clothes? You're a rich man. You act like you're afraid to spend a penny." "I am," said Charles. "Why?" "I might have to give it back." "Still harping on that? If there was anything wrong, don't you think we'd have heard about it by now?" "I don't know," said Charles. "I'd rather not talk about it." But that night he brought up the subject again. "There's one thing bothers me," he began.
"About the money?"
"Yes, about the money. If you make that much money, there's bound to be a mess."
"How do you mean?"
"Well, papers and account books and bills of sale, notes, figuring. Well, we went through Father's things and there wasn't none of that."
"Maybe he burned it up."
"Maybe he did," said Charles. The brothers lived by a routine established by Charles, and he never varied it. Charles awakened on the stroke of 4:30, as surely as though the brass pendulum of the clock had nudged him. He was awake, in fact, a split second before 4:30. His eyes were open and had blinked once before the high gong struck. For a moment he lay still, looking up into the darkness and scratching his stomach. Then he reached to the table beside his bed, and his hand fell exactly on the block of sulfur matches lying there. His fingers pulled a match free and struck it on the side of the block. The sulfur burned its little blue bead before the wood caught. Charles lighted the candle beside his bed. He threw back his blanket and got up. He wore long gray underwear that bagged over his knees and hung loose around his ankles. Yawning, he went to the door, opened it, and called, "4:30, Adam. Time to get up. Wake up." Adam's voice was muffled.
"Don't you ever forget?"
"It's time to get up." Charles slipped his legs into his pants and hunched them up over his hips. "You don't have to get up," he said. "You're a rich man. You can lay in bed all day."
"So are you.
We still get up before daylight.
You don't have to get up, Charles repeated. But if you're going to farm, you'd better farm.
Adam said ruefully, So we're going to buy more land so we can do more work.
Come off it, said Charles. Go back to bed if you want to.
Adam said, I bet you couldn't sleep if you stayed in bed. You know what I bet? I bet you get up because you want to, and then you take credit for it, like taking credit for six fingers.
Charles went into the kitchen and lighted the lamp. You can't lay in bed and run a farm, he said. And he knocked the ashes through the grate of the stove and tore some paper over the exposed coals and blew until the flame started. Adam was watching him through the door.
You wouldn't use a match, he said.
Charles turned angrily. You mind your own goddamn business. Stop picking at me.
All right, said Adam. I will. And maybe my business isn't here.
That's up to you. Anytime you want to get out, you go right ahead.
The quarrel was silly, but Adam couldn't stop it. His voice went on without his willing it, making angry and irritating words. You're damn right I'll go when I want, he said. This is my place as much as yours.
Then why don't you do some work on it?
Oh, Lord, Adam said. What are we fussing about? Let's not fuss.
I don't want trouble, said Charles.
He scooped lukewarm mush into two bowls and spun them on the table.
The brothers sat down. Charles buttered a slice of bread, gouged out a knifeful of jam, and spread it over the butter. He dug butter for his second slice and left a slop of jam on the butter roll.
God damn it, can't you wipe your knife? Look at that butter.
Charles laid his knife and the bread on the table and placed his hands palm down on either side. You better get off the place, he said.
Adam got up. I'd rather live in a pigsty, he said. And he walked out of the house.
It was 8 months before Charles saw him again. Charles came in from work and found Adam sloshing water on his hair and face from the kitchen bucket. Hello, said Charles. How are you?
Fine, said Adam.
Where'd you go?
Boston.
No place else?
No. Just looked at the city.
The brothers settled back to their old life, but each took precautions against anger. In a way, each protected the other, and so saved himself. Charles, always the early riser, got breakfast ready before he awakened Adam. And Adam kept the house clean and started a set of books on the farm. In this guarded way, they lived for 2 years before their irritation grew beyond control again. On a winter evening, Adam looked up from his account book.
It's nice in California, he said. It's nice in the winter, and you can raise anything there.
Sure, you can raise it, but when you got it, what are you going to do with it?
How about wheat? They raise a lot of wheat in California.
The rust will get to it, said Charles.
What makes you so sure? Look, Charles, things grow so fast in California, they say you have to plant and step back quick or you'll get knocked down.
Charles said, Why the hell don't you go there? I'll buy you out anytime you say.
Adam was quiet then. But in the morning, while he combed his hair and peered in the small mirror, he began it again.
They don't have any winter in California, he said. It's just like spring all the time.
I like the winter, said Charles.
Adam came toward the stove.
Don't be cross, he said.
Well, stop picking at me. How many eggs?
4, said Adam.
Charles placed 7 eggs on top of the warming oven and built his fire carefully of small pieces of kindling until it burned fiercely. He put the skillet down next to the flame. His sullenness left him as he fried the bacon. Adam, he said, I don't know whether you notice it, but it seems like every other word you say is California. Do you really want to go?
Adam chuckled.
That's what I'm trying to figure out, he said. I don't know. It's like getting up in the morning. I don't want to get up, but I don't want to stay in bed either.
You sure make a fuss about it, said Charles.
Adam went on. Every morning in the army, that damn bugle would sound, and I swore to God if I ever got out, I would sleep until noon every day. And here I get up a half hour before reveille. Will you tell me, Charles, what in hell we're working for?
You can't lay in bed and run a farm, said Charles. He stirred the hissing bacon around with a fork.
Take a look at it, Adam said earnestly. Neither one of us has got a chick or a child, let alone a wife. And the way we're going, it don't look like we ever will. We don't have time to look around for a wife. And here we're figuring to add the Clark place to ours if the price is right. What for?
It's a damn fine piece, said Charles. The two of them together would make one of the best farms in this section.
Say, you thinking of getting married?
No, that's what I'm talking about.
Come a few years, we'll have the finest farm in this section. Two lonely old farts working our tails off. Then one of us will die off, and the fine farm will belong to one lonely old fart. And then he'll die off.
What the hell are you talking about? Charles demanded. Fella can't get comfortable. You make me itch. Get it out. What's on your mind?
I'm not having any fun, said Adam. Or anyway, I'm not having enough. I'm working too hard for what I'm getting. And I don't have to work at all.
Well, why don't you quit? Charles shouted at him. Why don't you get the hell out? I don't see any guards holding you. Go down to the South Seas and lay in a hammock if that's what you want.
Don't be cross, said Adam quietly. It's like getting up. I don't want to get up and I don't want to stay down. I don't want to stay here and I don't want to go away.
You make me itch, said Charles.
Think about it, Charles. You like it here?
Yes.
And you want to live here all your life?
Yes.
Jesus, I wish I had it that easy. What do you suppose is the matter with me?
I think you got knocker fever. Come into the inn tonight and get it cured up.
Maybe that's it, said Adam.
But I never took much satisfaction in a whore.
It's all the same, Charles said. You shut your eyes and you can't tell the difference.
Some of the boys in the regiment used to keep a squaw around. I had one for a while.
Charles turned to him with interest.
Father would turn in his grave if he knew you was squawing around.
How was it?
Pretty nice. She'd wash my clothes and mend and do a little cooking.
I mean the other. How was that?
Good. Yes, good. And kind of sweet. Kind of soft and sweet. Kind of gentle and soft.
You're lucky she didn't put a knife in you while you were asleep.
She wouldn't. She was sweet.
You got a funny look in your eye. I guess you were kind of gone on that squaw.
I guess I was, said Adam.
What happened to her?
Smallpox.
You didn't get another one?
Adam's eyes were pained. We piled them up like they were logs. Over 200, arms and legs sticking out. And we piled brush on top and poured coal oil on.
I've heard they can't stand smallpox.
It kills them, said Adam.
You're burning that bacon.
Charles turned quickly back to the stove.
It'll just be crisp, he said. I like it crisp.
He shoveled the bacon out on a plate and broke the eggs in the hot grease, and they jumped and fluttered their edges to brown lace and made clucking sounds.
There was a school teacher, Charles said. Prettiest thing you ever saw.
had little tiny feet. Bought all her clothes in New York. Yellow hair, and you never saw such little feet. Sang, too, in the choir. Everybody took to going to church. Damn near stampeded getting into church. That was quite a while ago. About the time you wrote about thinking of getting married? Charles grinned. I guess so. I guess it wasn't a young buck in the county didn't get the marrying fever. What happened to her? Well, you know how it is. The women got kind of restless with her here. They got together. First thing you knew, they had her out. I hear she wore silk underwear. Too hoity-toity. School board had her out halfway through the term. Feet no longer than that. Showed her ankles, too, like it was an accident. Always showing her ankles. Did you get to know her? Adam asked. No, I only went to church. Couldn't hardly get in. The girl that pretty's got no right in a little town. Just makes people uneasy. Causes trouble. Adam said, Remember that Samuels girl? She was real pretty. What happened to her? Same thing. Just caused trouble. She went away. I heard she's living in Philadelphia. Does dressmaking. I heard she gets $10 just for making one dress. Maybe we ought to go away from here, Adam said. Charles said, Still thinking of California? I guess so. Charles' temper tore in two. I want you out of here, he shouted. I want you to get off the place. I'll buy you or sell you or anything. Get out, you son of a bitch. He stopped. I guess I don't mean that last, but God damn it, you make me nervous. I'll go, said Adam. In 3 months, Charles got a colored picture postcard of the bay at Rio, and Adam had written on the back with a splattery pen, It's summer here when it's winter there. Why don't you come down? 6 months later was another card from Buenos Aires. Dear Charles, my God, this is a big city. They speak French and Spanish both. I'm sending you a book. But no book came. Charles looked for it all the following winter and well into the spring. And instead of the book, Adam arrived. He was brown and his clothes had a foreign look. How are you? Charles asked. Fine. Did you get the book? No. I wonder what happened to it. It had pictures. Going to stay? I guess so. I'll tell you about that country. I don't want to hear about it, said Charles. Christ, you're mean, said Adam. I could just see it all over again. You'll stay around a year or so, and then you'll get restless, and you'll make me restless. We'll get mad at each other, and then we'll get polite to each other, and that's worse. Then we'll blow up, and you'll go away again. And then you'll come back, and we'll do it all over again. Adam asked, Don't you want me to stay? Hell yes, said Charles. I miss you when you're not here. But I can see how it's going to be just the same. And it was just that way. For a while, they reviewed old times. For a while, they recounted the times when they were apart. And finally, they relapsed into the long, ugly silences, the hours of speechless work, the guarded courtesy, the flashes of anger. There were no boundaries to time, so that it seemed endless passing. On an evening, Adam said, You know, I'm going to be 37. That's half a life. Here it comes, said Charles. Wasting your life. Look, Adam, could we not have a fight this time? How do you mean? Well, if we run true to form, we'll fight for 3 or 4 weeks, getting you ready to go away. If you're getting restless, couldn't you just go away and save all the trouble? Adam laughed, and the tension went out of the room. I've got a pretty smart brother, he said. Sure, when I get the itch bad enough,
I'll go without fighting. Yes, I like that. You're getting rich, aren't you, Charles? I'm doing all right. I wouldn't say rich. You wouldn't say you bought 4 buildings and the inn in the village? No, I wouldn't say it. But you did. Charles, you've made this about the prettiest farm anywhere about. Why don't we build a new house? Bathtub and running water and a water closet. We're not poor people anymore. Why, they say you're nearly the richest man in this section. We don't need a new house, Charles said gruffly. You take your fancy ideas away. It'd be nice to go to the toilet without going outside. You take your fancy ideas away. Adam was amused. Maybe I'll build a pretty little house right over by the woodlot. Say, how would that be? Then we wouldn't get on each other's nerves. I don't want it on the place. The place is half mine. I'll buy you out. But I don't have to sell. Charles' eyes blazed. I'll burn your goddamn house down. I believe you would, Adam said, suddenly sobered. I believe you really would. What are you looking like that for? Charles said slowly. I've thought about it a lot, and I've wanted for you to bring it up. I guess you aren't ever going to. What do you mean? You remember when you sent me a telegram for $100? You bet I do. Saved my life, I guess. Why? You never paid it back. I must have. You didn't. Adam looked down at the old table where Cyrus had sat, knocking on his wooden leg with a stick. And the old oil lamp was hanging over the center of the table, shedding its unstable yellow light from the round Rochester wick. Adam said slowly, I'll pay you in the morning. I gave you plenty of time to offer. Sure you did, Charles. I should have remembered. He paused, considering, and at last he said, You don't know why I needed the money. I never asked, and I never told. Maybe I was ashamed. I was a prisoner, Charles. I broke jail. I escaped. Charles' mouth was open. What are you talking about? I'm going to tell you. I was a tramp, and I got taken up for vagrancy and put on a road gang. Leg irons at night. Got out in 6 months and picked right up again. That's how they get their roads built. I served 3 days less than the second 6 months, and then I escaped. Got over the Georgia line, robbed a store for clothes, and sent you the telegram.
I don't believe you, Charles said.
Yes, I do. You don't tell lies. Of course I believe you. Why didn't you tell me? Maybe I was ashamed. But I'm more ashamed that I didn't pay you.
Oh, forget it, said Charles. I don't know why I mentioned it.
Good God, no. I'll pay you in the morning.
I'll be damned, said Charles. My brother, a jailbird.
You don't have to look so happy.
I don't know why, said Charles, but it makes me kind of proud. My brother, a jailbird.
Tell me this, Adam, why did you wait till just 3 days before they let you go to make your break?
Adam smiled.
2 or 3 reasons, he said. I was afraid if I served out my time where they'd pick me up again. And I figured if I waited till the end, they wouldn't expect me to run away.
That makes sense, said Charles.
But you said there was one more reason.
I guess the other was the most important, Adam said, and it's the hardest to explain. I figured I owed the state 6 months. That was the sentence. I didn't feel right about cheating. I only cheated 3 days.
Charles exploded with laughter.
You're a crazy son of a bitch, he said with affection.
But you say you robbed a store?
I sent the money back with 10% interest, Adam said.
Charles leaned forward.
Tell me about the road gang, Adam.
Sure I will, Charles. Sure I will.
This ends Disc 4. East of Eden, Disc 5.
Chapter 11.
Charles had more respect for Adam after he knew about the prison. He felt the warmth for his brother you can only feel for one who isn't perfect, and therefore no target for your hatred. Adam took some advantage of it, too. He tempted Charles.
Did you ever think, Charles, that we've got enough money to do anything we want to do?
All right, what do we want?
We could go to Europe. We could walk around Paris.
What's that?
What's what?
I thought I heard someone on the stoop.
Probably a cat.
I guess so. Have to kill off some of them pretty soon.
Charles, we could go to Egypt and walk around the Sphinx.
We could stay right here and make some good use of our money. And we could get the hell out to work and make some use of the day.
Those goddamn cats!
Charles jumped to the door and yanked it open and said, "Git!" Then he was silent, and Adam saw him staring at the steps. He moved beside him. A dirty bundle of rags and mud was trying to worm its way up the steps. One skinny hand clawed slowly at the stairs. The other dragged helplessly. There was a caked face with cracked lips and eyes peering out of swollen, blackened lids. The forehead was laid open, oozing blood back into the matted hair. Adam went down the stairs and kneeled beside the figure.
"Give me a hand," he said. "Come on, let's get her in. Here, look out for that arm. It looks broken."
She fainted when they carried her in.
"Put her in my bed," Adam said. "Now I think you better go for the doctor."
"Don't you think we better hitch up and take her in?"
"Move her? No. Are you crazy?"
"Maybe not as crazy as you think. Think about it a minute."
"For God's sake, think about what?"
"Two men living alone, and they've got this in their house." Adam was shocked.
"You don't mean it."
"I mean it, all right. I think we better take her in. It'll be all over the county in 2 hours. How do you know what she is? How'd she get here? What happened to her? Adam, you're taking an awful chance."
Adam said coldly, "If you don't go now, I'll go and leave you here."
"I think you're making a mistake. I'll go, but I'll tell you, we'll suffer for it."
"I'll do the suffering," said Adam. "You go."
After Charles left, Adam went to the kitchen and poured hot water from the tea kettle into a basin. In his bedroom, he dampened a handkerchief in the water and loosened the caked blood and dirt on the girl's face. She reeled up to consciousness, and her blue eyes glinted at him. His mind went back. It was this room, this bed. His stepmother was standing over him with a damp cloth in her hand, and he could feel the little running pains as the water cut through. And she had said something over and over. He heard it, but he couldn't remember what it was.
"You'll be all right," he said to the girl. "We're getting a doctor. He'll be here right off."
Her lips moved a little.
"Don't try to talk," he said. "Don't try to say anything."
As he worked gently with his cloth, a huge warmth crept over him.
"You can stay here," he said. "You can stay here as long as you want. I'll take care of you."
He squeezed out the cloth and sponged her matted hair and lifted it out of the gashes in her scalp. He could hear himself talking as he worked, almost as though he were a stranger listening.
"There, does that hurt? The poor eyes. I'll put some brown paper over your eyes. You'll be all right. It's a bad one on your forehead. I'm afraid you'll have a scar there. Could you tell me your name?" "No, don't try. There's lots of time. There's lots of time." "Do you hear that? That's the doctor's rig. Wasn't that quick?"
He moved to the kitchen door. "In here, Doc. She's in here," he called. She was very badly hurt. If there had been x-rays in that time, the doctor might have found more injuries than he did. As it was, he found enough. Her left arm and three ribs were broken, and her jaw was cracked. Her skull was cracked, too, and the teeth on the left side were missing. Her scalp was ripped and torn, and her forehead laid open to the skull. So much the doctor could see and identify. He set her arm, taped her ribs, and sewed up her scalp. With a pipette and an alcohol flame, he bent a glass tube to go through the aperture where a tooth was missing so that she could drink and take liquid food without moving her cracked jaw. He gave her a large shot of morphine, left a bottle of opium pills, washed his hands, and put on his coat. His patient was asleep before he left the room. In the kitchen, he sat down at the table and drank the hot coffee Charles put in front of him. "All right, what happened to her?" he asked. "How do we know?" Charles said truculently. "We found her on our porch. If you want to see, go look at the marks on the road where she dragged herself." "Know who she is?" "God, no." "You go upstairs at the inn. Is she anybody from there?" "I haven't been there lately. I couldn't recognize her in that condition anyway." The doctor turned his head toward Adam. "You ever see her before?" Adam shook his head slowly. Charles said harshly, "Say, what are you mousing around at?" "I'll tell you, since you're interested. That girl didn't fall under a harrow, even if she looks that way. Somebody did that to her. Somebody who didn't like her at all. If you want the truth, somebody tried to kill her." "Why don't you ask her?" Charles said. "She won't be talking for quite a while. Besides, her skull is cracked, and God knows what that will do to her. What I'm getting at is, should I bring the sheriff into it?"
"No."
Adam spoke so explosively that the two looked at him.
"Let her alone. Let her rest."
"Who's going to take care of her?"
"I am," said Adam.
"Now you look here," Charles began.
"Keep out of it.
It's my place as much as yours.
Do you want me to go?"
"I didn't mean that."
"Well, I'll go if she has to go."
The doctor said, "Steady down. What makes you so interested?"
"I wouldn't put a hurt dog out."
"You wouldn't get mad about it either. Are you holding something back? Did you go out last night? Did you do it?"
"He was here all night," said Charles. "He snores like a goddamn train."
Adam said,
"Why can't you let her be? Let her get well."
The doctor stood up and dusted his hands. "Adam," he said, "your father was one of my oldest friends. I know you and your family. You aren't stupid. I don't know why you don't recognize ordinary facts, but you don't seem to. Have to talk to you like a baby. That girl was assaulted. I believe whoever did it tried to kill her. If I don't tell the sheriff about it, I'm breaking the law. I admit I break a few, but not that one."
"Well, tell him. But don't let him bother her until she's better."
"It's not my habit to let my patients be bothered," the doctor said. "You still want to keep her here?"
"Yes."
"Your funeral. I'll look in tomorrow. She'll sleep. Give her water and warm soup through the tube if she wants it." He stalked out. Charles turned on his brother.
"Adam, for God's sake, what is this?"
"Let me alone."
"What's got into you?"
"Let me alone, you hear? Just let me alone."
"Christ,"
said Charles, and spat on the floor and went restlessly and uneasily to work. Adam was glad he was gone. He moved about the kitchen, washed the breakfast dishes, and swept the floor. When he had put the kitchen to rights, he went in and drew a chair up to the bed. The girl snored thickly through the morphine. The swelling was going down on her face, but the eyes